tiny in all that air. The Philip Larkin Society Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Tiny in All That Air. My name is Lynn Lockwood and I'm a trustee of the Philip Larkin Society. Today we're sending out a bonus podcast to mark Philip Larkin's birthday, which is August the 9th. Professor John White, our jazz consultant, explores Larkin's sense of humour in a talk from 2010. Expect a whirlwind of references and, inevitably, plenty of swearing.
Thank my friends for coming. Some came under duress, but they're all here. Okay, I'm going to start with some of the subheadings in index entries in Andrew Motion's biography, Philip Larkin, A Writer's Life. I think they offer rather chilling vignettes of Philip's personality and proclivities. Heading, health, hypochondria, X-ray panic, giddiness, agoraphobia. Next heading, shyness and gloom. Hermit of Hull, stammer, shyness, depression, apparent modesty. Next heading, sex. Homosexual inclinations, lesbian romances, pornography, complains about expense, sexual logbooks. Attitudes and opinions, dislike of children, loathing of abroad, right-wing politics, racism, fear of death. Last one, interests, jazz, smoking, drinking, pornography, cars. Motion forgot to mention origami and yodeling. I've just made those two up. But my point is, for those who knew Philip Larkin and or have read his poetry and his prose and his published letters, and not least have looked at his cartoons and doodles, Motion's rather lugubrious references need at least two additions, humour and wit. Now, some commentators have remarked on a smiling Larkin looking like the late Eric Morecambe. Larkin himself, after seeing some photographs taken for Faber, commented, quote, "I hadn't realised my affinities with the late Stan Laurel." But perception of looks depends on the countenance being displayed. Alan Bennett suggests that in the BBC Monitor programme broadcast in December 64, Larkin dressed in, and I quote, "his doleful raincoat with pebbled glasses, cycle clips, and oceanic feet bears more than a passing resemblance to the serial killer Reginald Halliday Christie." Haunting his cemeteries and churchyards, he could be on the verge of exposing himself. And whether it's to a grim, head-scarred wife from Hessel or in a slim volume from Faber and Faber, seems a bit of a toss-up. It could be a play on words there, I suppose. As for the allegedly morose hermit of Hull, Bennett believes, and I quote, that Albert Schweitzer in the Congo did not derive more moral credit than Larkin did for living in Hull. I think that's a bit unfair on Schweitzer, but anyway. Now, it's been pointedly ignored or denied by such sanctimonious and jaundiced critics as Brian Appleyard, Bonnie and Jermaine Greer, unrelated but sisters under the skin, obviously, Lisa Jardine and Tom Paulin. Philip Larkin, in fact, was a very funny man, as he more modestly informed Miriam Gross for an Observer interview in 1979, I think it was. "I like to think of myself as quite funny. I hope this comes through in my writing." And 13 years earlier, he'd told John Shakespeare, who was interviewing him for a profile in the TLS, or the TES, I'm sorry, "I hope you're not cooking up too villainous a caricature. I think of myself as dignified, melancholy, and amusing. And I shall certainly feel impelled to censor remarks giving a contrary impression." I hope he's listening tonight. I think Larkin might possibly have applauded Tom Courtenay's portrayal of him in the stage production Pretending to Be Me. Clive James praised what he called a bravura performance by an actor portraying, quote, a curmudgeon doing what curmudgeons do best, being sardonically funny about life. And then trailing Pretending to Be Me as a projected Hollywood biopic, James confided that Robert De Niro, quote, has already declared his interest, but to prepare himself for the role, he wants to spend 50 years in a library. Another contender, Bruce Willis, wants the Bryn Mawr Jones Library to be taken over by terrorists. The obvious choice for James was Jack Nicholson. Quote, nobody does sardonic better. He could recite his own death sentence and still sound funny. James suggested that Nicholson's depiction of the irascible old bastard Warren Schmidt in the movie about Schmidt is, quote, Philip Larkin without the bifocals. And then he imagined him actually playing Larkin, drawling out the line, your mum and your pup, they fuck you over, right? What was Larkin like in person? Well, Nick Russell, who was a fellow undergraduate with Philip at St. John's, remembered that, quote, with his large glasses, his high forehead, his attractive slow stutter, he was unmistakable. The sort of person who was not only witty in himself, but the cause of wit in other men. I do feel very strongly that Larkin's friends and colleagues at Hull and elsewhere would certainly endorse that encomium. In the Philip Larkin I knew, we have Maeve Brennan's assurance that, quote, humor throughout his life was the antidote to his endemic pessimism. It was what made him such an amiable companion. It transmuted all his darker thoughts and transform malice to goodwill. It was often gentle, sometimes acerbic, often narrative, always funny. More often than not, it was turned against himself. Unfortunately, some of the examples that she gives of Larkin's humor are less than rib-tickling. Peter Crowther, for example, a former library colleague, remembers vaguely the very many occasions on which he, Larkin, made dull staff committees meetings bearable by his hilarious wit and ability to mimic people. Little more concretely, Pauline Dennison, who was in charge of the issue desk here, said that whenever she made an appointment to see the librarian, he would mutter audibly in a Yorkshire accent as she came into his office, oh, here comes trouble at Tamil. Maeve explains, perhaps unnecessarily, this was a West Riding expression directed at a West Riding person. I thought it was Welsh. Larkin, Maeve Brennan also recounts, had a fondness for practical jokes. One of these involved a very attractive young assistant in the library. She was interlibrary loans, actually, and she'd helped a Middle Eastern scholar to track down a reference. And this scholar then expressed his appreciation to Philip when he next saw him. Larkin very quickly relayed this to the young librarian, although in an embroidered form, suggesting that he'd been offered a camel in exchange for her services in his harem back home. It's not very PC, this stuff, is it? And later, I quote Maeve, a small replica of a camel appeared, joined at intervals by similar figures, so that eventually a cavalcade of beasts trailed across her desk. Now, Ray Brett, some of you remember Ray, he was a dear friend of mine, professor of English at Hull, in a memoir written shortly before he died in 1996, recalled that, and I quote, Larkin had a keen sense of humor and was delighted in hearing or recounting an amusing anecdote, but his wit could be quite cutting in his comments on colleagues, even on those who counted themselves as his friends. And on one occasion, Brett had mentioned that a recently published collection of verse by a distinguished poet, who was in fact a close friend of Larkin's, was as good as his previous work. And this elicited the cruel rejoinder, you can't fall off the floor. Douglas Dunn, after taking up the post of fellow in creative writing at the Bryn Mawr Jones Library in 1974, asked Philip what his duties and obligations were, and Larkin replied, there's too much poetry on this campus. I'm relying on you to stamp it out. Come down hard on them. Now, our chairman, Eddie Dawes here, has recorded attending a ceremony marking the retirement of Vice Chancellor Sir Bryn Mawr-Jones in 1972, when Philip said, and I quote, that seeing him in the library, which bears his name, was rather like walking through St. Pancras Station and meeting St. Pancras. And when Sir Bryn Mawr's successor, Sir Roy Marshall, a distinguished lawyer, retired, the University Council decided that the law collection in the Bryn Mawr-Jones Library should be renamed the Sir Roy Marshall Library. And as Eddie remembers, this elicited from Philip the quip that, I can't help thinking there is something marsupial about putting the library of one vice chancellor inside that of another. Professor John Kenyon, who was a jazz friend of mine and Philip's, after he left the history department here in 1981, remembers receiving a handful of wonderful, what he called, atrabilious letters. I wonder where they are now. I'm trying to find out from Larkin. And then thinking about the time when John was here with Larkin, he recalled, and I quote, he once told me that when a young man comes to see me and says he wants to be a librarian, I always feel like saying, tell me, my boy, what's wrong? And then Kenyon goes on about Larkin, his wit, his effortless choice of the bon mot, the searching sarcasm, the offbeat phrase is almost legendary, as was his gift for mimicry. He could hit off a person's diction, gestures, facial expression with amazing exactness, without apparently changing his own very much. And Kenyon concludes and concedes that Larkin's imitation of him, Kenyon, was, quote, uncannily accurate. Now, novelist, travel writer, and sailor, perhaps yachtsman's the word he'd prefer, and critic Jonathan Raban was a graduate student at Hull and had met Larkin then. He met him again in 1982 in the lobby of the Royal Station Hotel. At the bar, Philip requested a double gin and tonic, quote, since I've gone so deaf, I don't seem able to see single gins anymore. When Raban suggested that they should have dinner at a local Lebanese restaurant, Larkin was incredulous. A Lebanese restaurant? In Hull? Good heavens. He then asked, what sort of food would one get in a Lebanese restaurant? Would it be mushy? Raban, fiercely defending my decision to escape the Royal Station Hotel, I said, no, you can get kebabs and salads and things like that. Larkin, but I like mushy food. It's the only food I really enjoy now. When Philip said that the pita bread that he tasted at the Lebanese restaurant was, quote, rather good, it tastes like Pharex, Raban reflected, I wasn't sure whether I was Larkin's confidant or his stooge. I think many of us have found ourselves in that position. But as I've mentioned what I'm calling here Larkin's foodism, Charles Monteith once received a letter from Philip, quote, thanking me for a lunch at which I had persuaded him, against his better judgment, to eat a Greek meal, in which he described Retsina as, quote, that interesting wine which tastes like cricket bats, which is, I think, an excellent definition of Retsina. When I was lecturing in America in the year 1984-85, Philip sent me several trenchant letters. In one of them, he confided that he was reading Peter Ackroyd's biography of T.S. Eliot, and I quote, which is pretty dull going. Not that Eliot wasn't Buffalo Bill compared to yours truly. Marvellous. He also suggested that I buy him a raccoon coat, quote, to wear indoors this winter. The estates office is already living up to its motto, heating people is wrong. We don't issue supplementary heaters when the main heating isn't on. Jesus. In another, he offered these Larkinian reflections on the recent appointment of a new vice chancellor at this university. Well, he said, the puff of smoke has come out of the chimney. The handful of doves have flown away into the sunlight. Hull University has a new VC. He's William Taylor, currently principal of University of London. 54, these young men. An educationalist who has written books with such riveting titles as Educational Administration in Australia. The appointing committee is punch drunk over him. I reserve my judgment. From the publicity picture, he looks a bit foxy. Now, if some upwardly mobile adults were foxy, all children were to be feared and despised. But I think Larkin's professed hatred of the species, which is second only to that of W.C. Fields, who said, you know this, I like children if they're properly cooked. Larkin's animosity was always expressed in serio-comic fashion. In his Observer interview that I mentioned at the beginning, he said, until I grew up, I thought I hated everybody. But when I grew up, I realized it was just children I didn't like. Children are very horrible, aren't they? Selfish, noisy, cruel, vulgar little brutes. And he pursued this theme in a review of Iona and Peter Opie's The Law and Language of School Children in 1959. It was that verse about becoming again as a little child that caused the first sharp waning of my Christian sympathies. If the kingdom of heaven could be entered only by those fulfilling such a condition, I knew I should be unhappy there. Children's skipping rhymes, games, and customs that are very painstakingly documented by the Opies left Larkin unimpressed. He questioned whether Mischief Night, the 4th of November, was in fact a national custom, but was only too well aware that it was, quote, spreading and growing more violent and disagreeable, unquote. He suggested, quote, a Herod's Eve to coincide with it, on which bands of adults might roam the streets and bash the hell out of anyone under 16 found out of doors. But there were some grounds for optimism. He pointed out that children are linked to adults by the simple fact that they are in the process of turning into them. For this, they may be forgiven much. Martin Amis relates, and I quote, famously, Larkin hated or professed to hate children, and of course never fathered any. I used to wonder when I began to read him if it was my brother and me who put him off. When I was a child, Larkin was mythologized for me at home as a mock epic miser and misanthrope. But I trust my sense of him then. Whenever our eyes met and held for a moment, he looked on me gently. And I felt, as well as pleasure and reassurance, a peculiarly childish disappointment, because he was supposed to be a red squirrel, an exotic, and he was being gray. Larkin also vented his mock spleen on children and childhood at the beginning of a review of the complete poems of Emily Dickinson and Walter de la Mare. And I quote this short extract. On the one hand, he says, the Freudian legacy assures us that our childhoods are with us for life. We cannot lose their gains or be compensated for their losses. On the other hand, children themselves have been devalued. We know them now for the little beasts they are, a knowledge greatly amplified since 1945 by the forcible reintroduction of a servantless middle class to its offspring. And nobody would pretend there was anything angelic about them, so that one of the major illusions of the Romantic movement has thereby quietly disappeared, like knives and forks from a university refectory. Jean Hartley records that Philip told her that he'd received a letter from her ex-husband George to announce the birth of a son, but he hadn't responded, quote, in case they asked him to be a godfather. And then Philip then added, and he sent me a photograph. Do you remember this? He sent me a photograph of a baby. It's like sending garlic to Dracula. In fact, babies seem to hold a particular mock terror for Larkin. Writing in 1955 to thank friends in London for some recent hospitality, he recounted that he'd endured a hellish journey back to Hull and, quote, on a filthy train next to a young couple with a slobbering chocolatey baby. I quite like chocolatey baby. Apart from a few splashes of milk, nothing happened to me, but the strain of feeling it might was a great one. Writing to Julie Egerton 5 years later, Larkin informed her that what he called the moral leper, i.e. Philip Larkin, would arrive at her London house around 8 p.m. Trust children will be chloroformed by then. And interviewed in 1981, Larkin conceded that his strictures against children were happily those of a childless person. I've never lived in hideous contact with them, having toast flung about at breakfast and so on. Perhaps worse than toast. I like worse than toast. This anecdotes again. Jean Hartley has other memories and anecdotes of Larkin as a funny man. When the Queen Mother came to the university in 1960, I think it was, to open the new library, Philip, she says, mimicked beautifully the Vice Chancellor's lilting Welsh accent. This is Mr. Larkin, our poet librarian. And the Queen Mother's piping reply. I can't do a piping reply, but oh, what a lovely thing to be. And Jean also tells us that every time he saw her, he told me a joke, but I usually forgot them. But she does remember one decidedly non-PC Irish joke that he'd heard on the telly after the snooker. Mother, Irish joke. Mother, I'm pregnant. Reply, are you sure it's yours? You see, okay, never mind. Richard Morrison has suggested that Larkin was to political correctness what Dame Barbara Cartland is to sumo wrestling, and I think that's a fair judgment. A bit more of Jean here. I told you were going to be on stage. When Jean asked Philip if he would like the cover photo of the LP sleeve for the less deceived, Philip reading his own poems, to quote, have a border or a bleed off, his face lit up. Bleed off, what a satisfying phrase. Christ, the number of people I'd like to have said that to this week. Oh, bleed off, you fucker. She then goes on to reflect, meeting Philip reconciled me to my own unrestrained swearing habit. I hope you still have it. I excused it to myself on the grounds that with a working class background, it was a disease you couldn't help catching, but at the same time, I couldn't help feeling it was the last resort of the inarticulate. Hearing some of Philip's well-constructed curses, however, made me appreciate swearing as an art form. Well, Larkin himself felt very strongly about language. He informed Jim Sutton in 1946 that, quote, the silly fool who runs the Fortune Press had sent off the manuscript of Jill, the novel, without having read it to the printers, and I quote, words like sod and bugger and fuck caused them to faint, and one girl nearly had hysterics. And therefore, the manager blue penciled the whole thing down to the last my God. Naturally, I objected to this when I got the proofs, and I am now replacing the milder swearing obstinately. But commenting to Julie Egerton in 1982 about his portrayal on the South Bank show, Larkin expressed what to me was a rather unconvincing mea culpa for his overuse of what we have to call the F word. As he wrote, there was rather too much of the four-letter Larkin for my liking. They fuck you up will clearly be my Lake Isle of Innisfree. I fully expect to hear it recited by 1,000 girl guides before I die. It might be an idea for Larkin 25, actually. Yeah. If you could. Writing to Robert Conquest in 1975, Larkin affirmed, quote, I'm no good at prose, especially funny prose, never was. His published letters suggest otherwise. Anthony Thwaite, the editor of those letters, says they are an informal record of the lonely, exuberant, desolate, close-fisted, generous, intolerant, compassionate, eloquent, foul-mouthed, harsh, and humorous Philip Larkin, who was not only one of the finest poets of our time, but also a compulsive and entertaining letter writer. And Thwaite rightly notes that Larkin was the most amusing, John Osborne said the same thing recently in print, the most amusing person and correspondent it had been his good fortune to know. Well, here are a few examples of what Thwaite's phrase, the cheerful and raucous prose. When Larkin was in correspondence with like-minded friends, I do stress that phrase, like-minded friends. This is not to Barbara Pym or Judy Egerton. And of course, the bête noire in many of the published letters, or a bête noire, he had several, does seem to have been Ted Hughes. Writing to Charles Monteith in 1975, Larkin said, Ted Hughes was here last week giving a reading, the first time since about 1962. He filled our hall, got a great reception. I was in the chair providing a sophisticated, insincere effete and gold watch chain alternative to his primitive, forthright, leather-jacketed persona. And later that month, he told Conquest, at Ilkley Literature Festival, a woman shrieked and vomited during a Ted Hughes reading. I must say, I never felt like shrieking. We had the old crow over at Hull recently, looking like a Christmas present from Easter Island. When Larkin, along with Ted Hughes, was invited to write a short poem, this was going to be inscribed on a stone in Queen's Square, London, very close to the Faber and Faber offices to mark the Queen's Jubilee, Charles Monteith got the following response: I'm no good at this lapidary lark. All three nights thought can produce is, quote, in times when nothing stood but worsened or grew strange, there was one constant good, she did not change. He says, you're welcome to the first British chiselling rights in that, but please don't print it. I'm sure Ted Hughes will do better. The skies split apart in malice. Stars rattle like pans on a shelf. Crows shat on Buckingham Palace. God pissed himself. I prefer the second to the first, actually. Now, you may now turn over your bits of paper, because I think to see the words next to each other this is a letter that Philip sent to Charles Osborne, Secretary of the Poetry Book Society. It's as funny as Lucky Jim's letter, I think, in the novel, I'm fond of pottery. I'd like to join the Poultry Book Society. I hop, Peyton Storm, Favourite. And of course, the clincher is yours respectfully, Pierre Larkin. Mrs. I think it's wonderful. Another example of the comical Larkin is his foreword to Barry Bloomberg's Philip Larkin, A Bibliography. In 1972, Bloomfield told Larkin that having completed the second edition of his Auden biography, he was now looking for a fresh victim. And Larkin recounts as follows: some 2 years passed before Mr. Bloomfield paid me a visit. But when he did, he already possessed a great deal more information than I should have believed possible. Any thoughts I may have had about glossing over certain literary indiscretions were dispelled. Mr. Bloomfield's normally friendly and undemanding demeanor now held disquieting overtones of the investigator, the auditor at times, even the Alcoholics Anonymous counselor. Soon I was supplying evidence against myself as eagerly as any Russian state trial defendant. When he left, he sent my secretary flowers, a kindly thought at the time that now seems immeasurably sinister. And Bloomfield, who was a very good friend of Philip's, as I'm sure you know, is also playfully castigated in a letter to Anthony Thwaite. He's like a one-man KGB or whatever. He keeps writing to ask if I remember what the games master said about me in the school magazine in 1938. Quote, must hollow his back in the scrum to get in a real shove. Sounds like old Calcutta or something. And then later on, as regards Barry Bloomfield, I think he's a member of the CID who was told to get Lucan, but misheard it and is making my life a misery. Now, as I've said this before, and I don't want to be particularly boring about this, but the majority of Larkin's admirers and detractors have not shared his passion for jazz. And I think that being the case, or if it is the case, they've missed some of his more ludic prose. Clive James correctly asserts that of all what jazz, quote, no wittier book of criticism has ever been written. But he cautions as follows: wits rarely tell jokes. Larkin's prose flatters the reader by giving him as much as he can take in at one time. As an example, he quotes Larkin's description of saxophonist John Coltrane as, quote, the master of the thinly disagreeable, who, quote, sounds as if he's playing for an audience of cobras. This is James. When he discovered that the blues singer Jimmy Rushing had said of John Coltrane, I don't think he can play his instrument, Larkin gleefully added that this accords very well with my own personal opinion that Coltrane sounds like nothing so much as a club bore who has been metamorphosed by a fellow member of magical powers into a pair of bagpipes. James then adds parenthetically, note Larkin's comic timing. A less witty writer would have put metamorphosed into a pair of bagpipes by a fellow member of magical powers, and so halve the effect. I was going to quote the introduction from All What Jazz. I'll just quote the famous bit, particularly because I know Bill Speck enjoys it as I do. This is Larkin's notorious introduction to All What Jazz, in which he imagines his readers, what he calls his remarkably tolerant readers. Sometimes I imagine them sullen, fleshy, inarticulate men, stockbrokers, sellers of goods, living in a 30-year-old detached house among the golf courses of outer London, husbands of aging and bitter wives they first seduced to Artie Shaw's Begin the Beguine, fathers of cold-eyed, lascivious daughters on the pill, to whom Ramsay MacDonald is coeval with Rameses II, and cannabis-smoking, jeans and bearded, steward-haired sons whose oriental contempt for bread, I mean bread in quotation marks, is equaled only by their insatiable demand for it. When the sales director at Faber & Faber asked Larkin to suggest some publicity angles that might promote All What Jazz, he received the reply that, quote, "It's only outside the jazz world that I'm referred to as an authority." He advised Faber to think of it as a freak publication and to, quote, "treat it like a book by T.S. Eliot on All in Wrestling." My own copy of the first edition of All What Jazz is inscribed "All the Best for John" from his illiterate, jazz-wise, foot-stomping colleague, Philip. In fact, Larkin was massively informed and perceptive, a massively informed and perceptive jazz critic. Writing in 1973, David Timms over there observed, and I quote, "Larkin's preferences in jazz are as strongly stated as his preferences in literature." More recently, this is an introduction to a compilation that I did with Richard Palmer. Alan Plater, I think, endorsed and even amplified that judgment, and I quote Plater, "As a critic, he, Larkin, was big enough to change his mind, but also smart enough to sniff the crap at 100 paces, especially when it was on the page. He's deeply intolerant of flabby prose and socio-econo-historical babble masquerading as thought." Larkin's intolerance of what Alan Plater calls flabby prose is evident in this acerbic review of Burnett James's Essays on Jazz, published in 1961. I quote, "Mr. James is a shocking writer. He's facetious. On Swinging Bach begins, 'I do not, of course, refer to submitting,'" he means subjecting, "Johann Sebastian Bach to capital punishment. He is intolerably long-winded. 'I do not advocate, still less do I contend. Let us put this a different way. He cannot resist dragging in culture references. Lester Young's mind possessed an almost Hazlitt-like sharpness. And these are not always the happiest. Quote, 'Every reader knows that Wordsworth only stood revealed as one of the half dozen or so greatest poets ever born of woman when he forgot his clever notions.'" Makes me feel a bit nauseous. But even when he was censorious, Larkin was also amusing. Reviewing George Melly's autobiography, Owning Up, he went and said as follows, "I can never watch," the verb is chosen advisedly, "I can never watch George Melly singing without feeling embarrassed. And the same goes for reading this book. He's so anxious to tell you which birds he had it off with, what character's armpits smell like the hallway of a cat-infested slum, and who peed in a washbowl when someone else had left a lettuce to soak, that free speech or not, one soon wishes he would belt up. It's not so much an adolescent desire to shock as an adolescent sense of humor." On page 37, he dismisses one of his cast as, quote, "overfond of the idea that 8 pints intensely. I have an awful compulsion to say fucking shit as well, but haven't dared to yet. It might horrify you that such things become important, but they do." On a sort of milder note, I think it's amusing, later Larkin then asked and informed Amos, again in 1943, "Did I tell you I might get a job as a committee clerk in Leamington? Well, I might." In fact, he didn't. "Under a democracy, an instrument of government for impeding unwelcome action is known as a committee. And so many of them are held that special clerks are deputed to attend them and write down what was said and done therein. I presume if Councillor Huggins mouths, 'The style of the shithouses down Wharf Street is a fucking disgrace,' you put down, Councillor Huggins suggested that the condition of the public conveniences in Wharf Street might be ameliorated. Kingsley Amis applauded and shared Larkin's real and imagined grievances. Writing in 1945, he called Larkin's letters, and I quote, "the above water visible part of a vast sunken continent of self-nourished, fantastically amusing malice." The last decade of his life, I think Larkin must have continued to amuse Amis with such confidences as the following. "My car burnt itself out last week. I mean, some jolly short circuit filled it with a nauseating stench, as if a heap of old-fashioned used French letters had been conflagrated inside it. Cost £58 to put it right. You're lucky to be alive, sir. Chap also gave me a list of other things wrong, he's noticed, things like brakes. If ever you feel," and this is the capital letters come out, "if ever you feel life's a bit too safe and unadventurous, or that you've got too much money, just you become a knight of the open road. Never a dull fucking moment, I can tell you." In his Daily Telegraph record, jazz record column in 71, Larkin referred to the buying of Christmas presents, and I've used this quote before, as, quote, "that annual conversion of one's indifference to others into active hatred." 10 years later, writing to Kingsley Amis, he expanded on this theme, and he coined, in Gene Hartley's phrase, I think, another of his well-constructed curses, "Christmas and New Year," spelled Y-A-H-E-R, "seem to get longer annually, and indeed do so. Eventually, the whole bloody fucking arsehole in country will be on its back from Guy Fawkes Night to St. Valentine's Day, is my guess," which was fairly accurate prophecy, I think. In 1985, a terminally ill Larkin admonished his friend not to assume that he was a Guardian reader. "I regard it as a paper written by comprehensive school teachers for comprehensive school teachers." But then he went on to say, "the amount of time you spend wondering what I read, I spend wondering what you watch on TV. I flinch from fearful sitcoms, Brit and US, features on disease, old age, death, animals eating and or fucking each other. Well, what else is there? Of course, up here, we're at the mercy of Yorkshire TV. The papers print Granada, so my heart leaps at 10 o'clock, Hammer Horror, The Red Room. 11:45, I particularly like this one, 11:45, Imprisoned in a Swedish Girls' School. 1:15, Close. But the small print for Yorkshire reads, 10:30, Australian Rugby League Action. 11:45, 5 minutes, i.e. Canting Religion. 11:50, Weather. 11:55, Close. After Larkin's death, Amis wrote, "he was the most enlivening companion I've ever known and the best letter writer. To the end, a glimpse of the Hull postmark brought that familiar tiny tingle of excitement like a reminder of youth." And Martin Amis, who's in bad odour at the moment because he's not very nice about people my age and even younger, but Martin Amis, reading his father's latter-day correspondence with Larkin, delighted in what he called the rejuvenation in their thrashed jokes, obscene misspellings, and yelping capitalizations. And he concludes that, quote, "when he, Larkin, dies in 1985, the narrative of Kingsley's letters take on a stunned and defeated feel." We're almost there. Throughout his life, my point is that Philip Larkin was comical. Peter Levy, is that the way I pronounce his name, the poet? I'm asking seriously, John will know this. Is it Peter Levy, the poet? Remembered, quote, "no poet I ever met was so entertaining, so generously witty, or such an enhancer of life to his friends." And Levy, I think, also hits the mark with the observation, "however gloomily he, Larkin, spoke about anything, his hidden or suppressed or unacknowledged high spirits constantly reveal themselves. It was as if at any moment he might break into a soft shoe shuffle." I think it's wonderful, wonderful. Well, mordant wit, I'm suggesting, and caustic humour suffuse many of Larkin's anecdotes and riposts. Recalling his interview to me for the post of librarian at this university, he told me that one member of the committee, quote, "resembled a fetus," while another was so frighteningly formal that he made an extremely correct colleague of mine in American studies, let's call him Philip Taylor, look, I quote, like Max Miller. On another occasion, when I told him loftily that my tastes in jazz were more Catholic than his, he snorted, "You mean you're one of those buggers who likes everybody?" Well, Clive James reminds us that Larkin's wit is evident in, it's probably even the wellspring of his poetry. Church-going had the ruined bibber, Randy for antique. Toads had the pun on Shakespeare, stuff your pension being the stuff dreams are made on. In the Whitson weddings, Mr. Bleeny has the bodies, and naturally the foundation will bear your expenses, has the ineffable Mr. Lau. Sonny Prestatyn features Titch Thomas, and in Wild Oats, a girl painfully reminiscent of Margaret in Lucky Jim is finally shaken loose after about 5 rehearsals. I'm cutting this down a bit. Vers de Satiété has the bitch who's read nothing but witch. And James also contends, I think persuasively, that Larkin's poetry is all witty, which is to say that there's none of his language which does not confidently rely on the intelligent reader's capacity to apprehend its play of tone. In fact, John Banville, I saw recently, has asked the question, has there ever been a funnier, serious poet than Philip Larkin? Well, if Larkin said to Miriam Gross, it's, quote, unhappiness that provokes a poem, that unhappiness could receive highly comic expression. Again, as Hugo Williams suggests, I quote, with Larkin, humor and melancholy are so finely blended, they're almost the same thing. Well, nowhere, I think, is this more evident than in Self's the Man. Arnold, I think, should certainly join the roster of Larkin's ironic creations. Andrew Motion explains, in its immediate impetus was to deride his deputy librarian, Arthur Wood, transformed in the poem into Arnold, who on the 29th of September 1958 returned from his summer holiday with his, quote, Glasgow bookie suit on, unquote, making Larkin wish he could drive a horse and cart over him. Motion says, in truth, Wood had done nothing in the library to deserve Larkin's wrath, which was always expressed in terms so hilariously extreme as to appear deliberately unreasonable. Back in the same year, 1958, Larkin wrote to his mother, quote, Mr. Wood's driving lessons continue, and there is no sign of his being killed. I think he drives too carefully. I must tell him that a good driver is a fast driver. Maeve Brennan remembered the showing at library staff parties of what she calls some slapstick comedy homemade films that had been clandestinely put together, obviously with Philip's approval, by Alan Marshall, who was then the university photographer. And one of these films depicted Arthur Wood apparently throwing himself off the roof of the library, which I'd like to see very much. Well, mercilessly derided and lampooned by Larkin during his lifetime, the hapless Wood, in fact, received what I think of as a kind of posthumous seal of at least ambiguous approval in Self's the Man. The clue is in the last line. Larkin and Craig Raine's happy phrase always, quote, included himself with the mass of humanity. My colleague Trevor Tolley suggests that, quote, the title, Self's the Man, points into a satirizing of the very unpleasant speaker who shares with Larkin his unmarried state. The married life of the contrasted Arnold is portrayed in terms of music hall stereotypes, the nagging wife, the visiting mother-in-law, yet at the same time, it's all much too funny for the reader to disengage himself from Self's view of Arnold. Well, if I understand more recent Larkin scholarship, and I'm looking at John Osborne over here, we don't know that Arnold is Arthur Woods. We don't know that I is Philip Larkin. So we can enjoy the poem in its own right without experiencing politically correct and inappropriate feelings of guilt. So in conclusion, I simply ask, was Philip Larkin a funny man? My answer is, you bet he was. Just listen. Thank you.
This podcast was produced by me, Lynn Lockwood, and Gavin Hogg, and the music was The Horns of the Morning by The Mechanicals Band. If you have any questions, comments or ideas for future topics, then please, as ever, do get in touch.
Of the morning are blowing, are shining. The meadow is wet with the coldest of dew. The dawn reassembles.